Does everyone have a syllabus? Okay, great. Also, those of you in the back, can you hear me okay? Because there's a mic here, and I'm never quite sure if it's loud enough back there. If there's a problem ever in the course of the quarter, just cup your ear or make some sort of sign, so I'll know to turn up the microphone. Anyway, this is PolySci 138A, which is the first quarter of a two-quarter survey of international politics in modern times. Students don't like this course as much as they like 138B. Why? Because 138B, which covers the 20th century, the period of the First World War, the Second World War, Cold War, you know, right up to the present. It's just much more exciting. It's much more interesting and substantively, right? The element of drama is much greater when you look at the 20th century. 19th century, by comparison, not nearly as exciting. Yeah, there were some wars in the course of the 19th century. But basically, it's a peaceful century as far as international politics is concerned. Culminates in the First World War. That's going to be the culminating event of the course this quarter. But still, when you look at the 19th century, what do you have? The Crimean War, the wars of German unification, so on. Small potatoes in comparison with the wars of the 20th century. Nevertheless, the 19th century has its own interest. Why? Because when you study international relations, when you study, when you try to understand how international politics works, there's this great question that stands at the heart of the analysis. You've all had other courses in international relations, I assume. You've all been, you know, exposed to kind of the rudiments of international relations theory. You all have some sense for what was meant by the whole body of thought we call realism. The set of issues connected with realism lie at the heart of this whole area of inquiry. This whole problem, how international politics works. To what extent do power considerations play a central role in international politics? Suppose everything else, all kinds of ideological, moral considerations, regime type, and so on. The 19th century is of interest in that context because this is not a highly ideological period. You don't have really sharp ideological divisions among the great powers. An approximation of what political scientists, international relations theorists, refer to as anarchy. What do they mean by the term anarchy? Does it mean just chaos, no rhyme or reason to what happens? No. Anarchy has a very specific meaning, as I'm sure most of you are aware, in international relations theory. Anarchy simply means the absence of overriding authority. The absence of some sort of supranational authority that lays down the laws to the states within the system. Right? Simply means, no one's there to protect you. You have to look out for yourself. This is a phrase people use to kind of describe this. There's no 911 number that states can call if they get into trouble. They have to provide for their own security. They have to, maneuver in the international system. They have to be concerned with the quality of their relations with the other powers in the system. They have to be concerned with the structure of power in the system. Power considerations in an anarchical world are fundamental. Not just fundamental, but they're essentially what drives international politics, according to that body of theory. Well, is it right or not? Why do we have to concern ourselves with the issue of whether it's right or not? Because how do you go about thinking about these issues of how international politics works? Somebody makes some sort of argument about, the United Nations is very important. in international affairs, or democracy is very important, or world law is very important. How do you go about assessing claims of that sort? And just think about it. You know, if someone said, how would you go about figuring out how important the United Nations was? Well, it's like you have to imagine the sort of world that would exist without it. Which means you have to reach some sort of theoretical understanding of how that kind of world would work. How an anarchical world would work. Right? And how do you hammer out your understanding of that general theoretical question? Just by, you know, trying to work it out in your own mind? Well, that's a little risky. You know, you want to kind of test your understanding of things by looking at how things work in the real world. And so you would want to look at a system that more or less approximates that kind of anarchical system. A system which is not, you know, heavily influenced by ideological conflict. A system in which power considerations do in fact play a central role. Right? Is this an inherently unstable system or not? Right? You can get at that issue by looking at the history. And you have to get at that issue if you want to be able to bring all these fundamental problems into focus. It's your basis for comparison, an understanding of how an anarchical system works, how a system based on power considerations works. Because only then can you compare it with the alternatives. Right? That's why the 19th century is of such, you know, fundamental interest from the standpoint of international relations theory. And you have to kind of have a taste for it because it's not nearly as dramatic as other periods. But it enables us to get insight into those fundamental questions. And what is the basic claim people make about how an anarchical system works? What's the basic claim that the leading realist theorists make? How many of you have heard of Kenneth Waltz? Just put your hands up. Right? The leading realist theorist of our own day. Very first reading, the first thing you'll be reading in this course, or at least one of the things that you're asked to read for this week, is this article in which Waltz sets out his whole understanding of how international politics works. And the basic argument that Waltz makes is that in this anarchical system, in a system based on power, in which states have to provide for themselves, and therefore they have to be concerned about their relative power position, because if they're weak, then they're vulnerable to predation, and no one's going to come in and help them, right? So they are always reaching for greater and greater power. But not every state in the system can become more powerful at the same time. Power is essentially a relative concept. And so there's an element of competition that's built into the very structure of an anarchical system. And states are competing for power. They're at odds with each other. They clash with each other. And so a system based on power, according to this Waltz theory, is an essentially unstable system. This is what explains why you have war. It's not regime type. It's not economic necessity or anything like that. It's what Waltz views as a purely political theory of great power politics, right? It's the competition for power that puts states at odds with each other. And this is what explains what Waltz refers to in that article as the dismal recurrence of war throughout the centuries. Right? It's a structural theory. You don't need aggressors to have wars. This is the argument runs. States, they don't have to want to change the status quo as an end in itself. They would be perfectly happy, maybe, to live with the status quo if they could get some sort of guarantee that everyone else would. But there is no such guarantee in an anarchical system. No one's going to, you know, intervene to pull your chestnuts out of the fire for you. You're gonna have to do it yourself. And the argument runs that in that kind of world, where states are just concerned with their own security, with their purely defensive interests, with just, you know, preventing themselves from being overrun, from seeing their independence sacrificed. In that kind of system where you don't really have aggressors, you could still have a war. The problem is built into the very structure of international politics, into the anarchical structure of international politics. This is the Waltz argument. That's why it's called structural realism. That's why there's all this emphasis on the structure of power rather than the intent of statesmen. Right? So it contradicts the kind of common sense theory of why you have war. Yes, somebody in the street, how in general would you explain why you have wars? Well, they're aggressors. Aggressors come down and they attack peace-loving states, and that's why you have conflicts. Look at the wars of the 20th century. The argument is right. Well, says no, that's not it at all. It's counterintuitive. You don't need aggressors. It's a structural problem. Okay, now that whole issue, whether Waltz is right, is going to be in a sense the focus for this course. If you note from the syllabus, the final exam is going to be broken down into two parts. One's going to be an in-class exam in the very last day of classes that's just basically factual stuff. Then there'll be a take-home final where you'll be asked to basically figure out whether that basic Waltz theory is correct in the light of what you've learned in the course. So that issue, that conceptual issue, will act as a focus for your thinking this course. Right? We're not interested in, quote, testing theories, which is kind of problematic in itself. We're interested in using these theories as kind of lenses for bringing problems into focus and giving us a handle for thinking about these central issues so that we can get insight into this fundamental question of war and peace. This is a question that lies at the heart of the whole discipline of international relations. It's a whole question of how international politics works. Is a world based on power essentially unstable? Or does it have a stability of its own? Because if it has, if it is unstable, then what that suggests is that we need somehow to kind of blunt the edge, the hard edge of international politics, by bringing in maybe these other factors like a concern with human rights or international law or spreading democracy or what have you. Maybe ideology has a proper role to play. If an anarchic regime, an anarchic world is essentially unstable, maybe we need to figure out some way from moving away from that. On the other hand, if you answer the question the opposite way and say, well, an anarchic system, contrary to what Waltz wants you to believe, is not that bad. A system based on power has its own stability. Right? Well, that will lead you to an entirely different set of conclusions about the right sort of policy to pursue. Maybe all that stuff, spreading democracy, ideological foreign policies, maybe they're counterproductive. Maybe they upset the natural equilibrium of the system based on power. And you can see how fundamental the set of issues is. And as I say, the basic premise of the course, what I call the philosophy of the course, is that you can't get at these issues simply by tackling them in a purely abstract level. You gotta think about them in concrete empirical context. You gotta think of them in historical context. You gotta bring them down to earth so that they become intellectually manageable, right? So the history enables us to get a handle on the theory, on these theoretical issues. And the theory allows us to bring the historical issues into focus and to draw meaning from an analysis of the historical record. You can always teach just history in this very flat, purely factual way. This happened and that happened, and this is what this statesman wanted, and then this happened, and that happened. It's like, what's the point? You listen to discussions of that sort, or you read historical books that are devoid of any theoretical orientation, and you say, what's the point? Who cares about this stuff? Tell me what all this stuff means. And by approaching the history with a set of theoretical issues in mind, you can get some sense for what the history is. Right? So that's what we're going to do. This is, in many ways, a hybrid course. I used to teach for 26 years. I taught in the history department. And I taught a course that was, in many ways, this same course. 80% of it was the same, straight history. This is a political science course. So we're going to, generally begin the lectures with the theoretical issue and then look at the history with and the basic idea will be, okay, what does the history tell us? What insight does the history give us into the set of problems that political scientists, international relations theorists are interested in? It's like 80% history, but we still have that 20% theory, both at the beginning and the end of each lecture, right? So it'll serve to kind of bring the history alive and give you a sense for what meaning it has. And also, with regard to the theory, it'll bring the theory down to earth. So these aren't just simply abstract generalities, but it'll give you a feel that we're talking about real stuff, okay? Okay. Now, about the nuts and bolts of the course. You have the syllabus. It should lay it out fairly clearly for you. Midterm exam. And the first part of the final exam. Very straightforward stuff. Factual stuff. Basic facts. No tricky things like where is the Sanjak of Nobi Bazaar or anything like that. It'll be things that everyone in this course should know. Probably things that you didn't know before you took a course like this. Yeah. We're the five great powers of Europe. I don't want you to know stuff like that. You should be able to put the basic facts in chronological order. You should be able to talk about what was distinctive about the foreign policy of the key diplomatists of the period that we're talking. It's stuff that it's touched on in a lecture, often touched on in the readings as well. So you gotta come to the lectures. They'll be, in theory, there'll be a podcast. It doesn't always work, so the podcast you should think of is just the backup. It's important to actually come to the lecture itself. Anyway, so you have these two exams that are going to cover, the basic facts of the course plus the readings. It's like important that you understand the readings. That you, when you read the stuff, don't just read it mindlessly, like this sponge just trying to absorb what people are saying line by line. You have to read things actively. You have to ask yourself, when you begin to read a text, what's the point here? What's the author trying to convince me of? Right? And how does the author go about doing it? And how successful is that? In other words, you have to read things critically, actively. And the technique here is very simple, and it's an important technique that everyone should learn. So first you identify the author's thesis, the core argument. You look at the title and you think, what does the title mean? You look at the first and last paragraph. If it's a book, you look at chapter titles. First and last paragraph, first and last sentence in each chapter. The book as a whole, you look at the introduction, the conclusion, things like that. Those are the things where an author's going to tip his or her hand, right? And once you kind of identify the thesis, then you say to yourself, well, how does the author go about, proving it? And then you read the text with that question in mind, using that question to draw out what's important in the text. And you say to yourself, does this stuff really prove what the author wants me to believe it proves? It's a powerful technique, very efficient. It'll take you less time to read things that way than if you do it in the usual passive way. Okay. In order to kind of encourage you to read things like that, I'm promising you now that on these exams there will be questions about the readings. What is the basic point here? And also kind of, what do you make of it? We're going to have like a couple of things in the course of the quarter where people make very clear arguments, sometimes at variance with each other. There'll be three things that you'll be reading about the origins of the Franco-Prussian War, for example. Parts of books by Gordon Craig, by Otto Flanza, and an article by S. William Hill. And they differ from each other. You want to identify those differences and then try and figure out who's right. And the whole idea here is you want to put yourself in control of these very important issues. You know, you don't want to just say, oh, who am I, poor undergraduate, how could I possibly make up my mind? I guess I just better accept what other people say. No, if you want to kind of get at these fundamental issues, first you have to understand the connection between these broad problems of, you know, what makes for war? What makes for a stable international system? What makes for good foreign policy? You've got various answers people give. And then the body of empirical evidence that relates to them, right? How do you go about answering those questions? Well, certainly an analysis of the empirical evidence, you bear on it in some way. You want to figure out what that connection is. You want to pull the conceptual side and the empirical side together, because that's what real learning is. That's what real understanding is. That's a fundamental technique that will enable you to see beyond your own preconceptions. Right? So you have that goal. And by reading things in that, you'll be able to reach conclusions of your own that will then, because you've established the connection between the large general questions and the kind of specific historical interpretations, you'll be able to get insight into those general issues. You know, if it turns out that Craig is wrong and Flanza is right about the origins of the War of 1871, well, that tells you something about what makes for war in general. It gives you insight into these basic theoretical issues. And so the only way you could make that sort of assessment is using that active technique, identifying what an argument is, trying to figure out what supports it, as far as the author is concerned. Right? So that's it's fundamental. And as I say, this is one of the skills that's going to be tested. And I'll be talking about this stuff in the lectures when we deal with, say, the origins of the War of 1871. We'll talk about Flanza and Craig and so on. When we talk about the July crisis in 1914, we'll talk about the two Fritz Fischer readings that will be signed that week and so on. So this kind of take you through it, show you how this sort of analysis is done, and so that you can see how it relates to getting insight into these very broad questions that define the field. Okay? What else? Then I talk about the H1N1 business, which, as I say, may be a problem this quarter. Hope not. Books, one book for you to buy, the Normovich book. It should be over in the UCLA store. If it isn't, let me know right away. If you have any problems with any of these things, be sure and let me know. The readings themselves, or at least the required readings, other than the Rich book, they're in a course pack that you can get over in Westwood Copies, which is on Gailey, just below Wake. Anything else of a technical nature that I should talk about. Does everyone know how to get the Bruncast? If you have any problem with the figuring out where the website is for Bruncast, just let me know. It's you have to kind of log in using your Bruin Online. It's not openly available. As far as office hours, the list of the syllabus, Wednesday right after class for a couple of hours. Try and see me in person. Please don't deal with me by email. It's just it's not a real interaction. You could always catch me right after class if you like. What else? Oh yeah, if there's anybody in here who's not officially signed up for the class, there's a system for getting PTE numbers that's outlined on the course website. So just look at it there. There's a form to fill out, and try and get the form into me by tomorrow, and I'll let you know by Wednesday if you're in the class. Okay. Are there any questions of a technical nature about the course, about what's required? No. All perfectly clear. I love that. All right. In the time that's remaining, the 25 minutes that we have left, I'll try and give you a very general introduction to European history in the 19th century. This is basically a course in European great power politics. In conjunction with one of the about to give you, I actually put two things on the course website that you might want to read. Recommended readings. An article by a very famous historian, Louis Nainier, called Basic Factors in 19th Century European History. And an article by a distinguished contemporary historian of international relations, Paul Kennedy, on, which is also an overview of the basic factors shaping international politics in the 19th century. The Kennedy thing is called The First World War and the International Power System. It's actually about events leading up to the First World War. Changes in the structure of power. They're both very interesting pieces. The Nainier thing, this is not simply a list of basic factors. It's not simply one of these dry historical overviews, right? There's a real conceptual core here. One of the things you have to understand when you look at the historical literature is that really important works of history have a conceptual core. These people are not stupid. Nainier has an argument to make, which I'll be touching on in a little while if I get a chance. We're concerned in this course with international politics, but it's one of the basic premises, at least in my approach to the subject, that what goes on in international politics can't be divorced from what's going on in history more generally, from fundamental political changes taking place within states, within societies, fundamental economic changes, fundamental demographic changes, absolute terms and in relative terms, demographic changes in states relative to each other. Now that's not Waltz's view, Waltz doesn't think things like that are very important for him. It's the structure of the system, the unchanging structure of the system that explains war's dismal recurrence through the centuries, he says. But, it's an important issue, and to kind of get at it, you want to kind of look at the other kind of argument, the argument that looks beyond the international system for an understanding of why you have problems in international politics. And these changes, for the purposes of discussion today, I'm breaking down into these three categories. Political, meaning the changes associated with the French Revolution, the Great French Revolution that began in 1789, that eventually led to generational warfare, culminating in the wars of Napoleon, Napoleon's attempt to kind of dominate Europe, and leading finally to the defeat of Napoleon at the hands of a coalition of all the other great powers of Europe. And there were four other great powers besides France. You know, Britain, Napoleon's most consistent adversary, Russia, and the two Germanic powers, Austria and Prussia. You see on the map, Prussia is that blue, and Austria is the kind of yellowish-orange there. Right? They defeat Napoleon. Actually, they defeat him twice. First time, he's exiled to the island of Elba, and he comes back, and then raises another army, and he meets the Allies at Waterloo, and he's defeated again. In which case, he's exiled to a much safer place, the island of St. Helena in the South Atlantic. What are the political changes associated with the French Revolution, and why are they important? You might say, well, these revolutionary forces were defeated. The French were defeated. The conservative powers won. You know, this is a period of restoration. The threat to the established order had been met, right? Turning the clock back. Well, no, there was no turning of the clock back to the pre-1789 period. There was a sense that, oh yes, Europe, conservative Europe, had won, but just barely. Its victory over the forces of revolution, forces of democracy, of the empowerment of the masses of the population, which is what the French Revolution stood for. Forces that looked to overturn the old order, the old kind of feudal or semi-feudal order where power was in the hands of an elite at the top of the social system. That attempt had been frustrated, but just barely. The forces that had given rise to it were by no means dead. And this meant that the victor powers, Britain and Russia and Austria and Prussia, and even to a certain extent the new French regime, the Bourbon regime that had been restored to rule in France after the fall of Napoleon, had an interest in keeping conflicts among themselves to an absolute minimum. Okay. This is a quotation from Lord Castlereagh, who's the dominant figure in British foreign policy in this period. Okay. Really remarkable individual. And Castlereagh says, the existing concert of the powers is their only perfect security against the revolutionary embers more or less existing in every state of Europe. And true wisdom is to keep down the petty contentions of ordinary times and to stand together in support of the established principles of social order. In other words, limit your conflict. Don't give free play to the to narrow, selfish national interest, in the interest of your own particular state, but think also in terms of the common interest of the powers and the maintenance of the established order. Think in terms of the interest of Europe as a whole, not just of your narrow, particular state interests. It wasn't just Castlereagh who spoke in those terms. Because that attitude, rooted in this fear of revolution, was one of the key elements in shaping international politics in the first half of the 19th century, from the period of the Congress of Vienna that ended the Napoleonic Wars, and I'll be talking about that next time, in 1814, 1815, laid out the basic structure of the system, down through the crises of the middle of the 19th century, the crises that began with the revolutions of 1848. Okay? But the first half of the 19th century, so it's not a period of unrestrained great power conflict. Quite the opposite. Why? Because this fear of revolution tied to the experiences of the French Revolution played a key role. And there was another way in which the French Revolution was important. The French Revolution had revealed the power of these new ideas, these new notions of national sovereignty, of drawing on the energies, not just of the elite, but of the mass of the population, mobilizing the mass of the population. The whole notion of the nation in arms, central to the French revolutionary experience, explains why France was able to practically defeat all the rest of Europe. And it was understood that those forces could be drawn upon, needed to be drawn upon, in order to generate enough power to be able to provide for your own security. Right? See. This is another quotation from key Prussian statesman Baron Hardenberg. He wrote to the Prussian king after the really devastating defeat of Prussia by France in 1807. He says, "The French Revolution, of which the current wars are an extension, has brought the French people a wholly new vigor, despite all their turmoil and bloodshed. All their sleeping energies have been awakened. Those who stood in the path of the torrent have been swept away. It's an illusion to think that we can resist the revolution effectively by clinging more closely to the old order, by proscribing the new principles without pity. This has been precisely the course which has favored the revolution and facilitated its development. The force of these principles is such, their attraction and diffusion is so universal, that the state which refuses to acknowledge them will be condemned to submit or to perish." Right? We have to, here we are, representatives of the old Prussian ruling elites, and we have to draw on the energies of our own people. We have to, to a certain extent, accommodate to the forces revealed by the French Revolution. Right? The nationalist fervor of our own people. Movement away from the feudal system, from the remains of the feudal system. Right? There had to be this accommodation. This, incidentally, is very much in line with one of the aspects of the whole Waltz theory, which is how the competitive pressures that you find in a system, an anarchical international system, the need for countries to do whatever they have to do to provide for their own security, means that each of them is going to adopt whatever techniques have been shown to enhance the power of the state. And so you have this movement toward popular sovereignty, toward self-determination. Okay? And people think that, that's a good thing. That democracy is a good thing. Insofar as international stability is concerned. That was not the view of people at the time. People like Lord Castlereagh, Britain is by far the most liberal of the European countries at the time. Castlereagh, as you see from the first of the two Castlereagh readings that were signed this week, Castlereagh is very concerned about what's going on in Germany, about how the Prussians are playing that particular card, stirring up the passions, the nationalist passions of their own people. And you'll see when you read that Name Your article if you do read it, how Name Your views all this as a double-edged sword, that we think of democracy and liberty as going hand in hand. But Namier's argument is, no, these things are important ways. They work across purposes, right? Liberty means constitutional development. It means what goes on within a given state, structure. You know, whereas popular sovereignty basically challenges the existing state structure and basically says nations, which may lie outside of a particular state, have the right to kind of come together, have the right to kind of control their own destiny. Not necessarily a force for stability. That's what Castlereagh thought. This is, again, another important factor. Okay? Very briefly, the last two factors. The economic factor. This period of the 19th century, or the period, say, from the late 18th century through the early 19th century, is of extraordinary importance in world economic history. This is the period of the Industrial Revolution. Developments that began in Britain and were gradually spreading into the continent, especially to the western part of the continent. And in the syllabus, I give you a link to a set of maps and tables that I should look that up. It's one of the required things for this week. And one of those tables, this table three, it's a breakdown. It's covered from a book by Paul Kennedy. It's a breakdown of relative shares of world manufacturing output. You can see from that the extraordinary impact that the Industrial Revolution had. Well, for one thing, is it changed Europe's position with regard to the rest of the world in a very dramatic way. It propelled Europe into a dominant position over the rest of the world, one of the striking features of the 19th century. In 1750, only a quarter of world manufacturing output was produced in Europe. By 1860, it was over a half. By 1900, almost two-thirds. It's an extraordinary change. Britain in 1715 alone, only 1.9% of world manufacturing output in 1750, essentially the start of the Industrial Revolution. By 1880, Britain was producing 23%, from 2% to 23%. What an extraordinary change. Right? Want to understand the whole phenomenon of imperialism? Half the answer is given by those figures. Enormous shift in the structure of power, because manufacturing input is an index for the structure of power. Yeah. What you produce can be harnessed to your war machine. Countries that produce the most are the ones that are able to generate the most military power. And so these economic figures are of fundamental political importance, also with regard to relations of the European states among themselves. You have the extraordinary rise of Britain, as I say, from only 2% of world manufacturing output in 1750 to 23% in the late 19th century. You know, more than any of the other European countries. You find Russia, which has kind of held its own with regard to Britain at the very beginning of the period, really falling very far behind. You know, this is a period of decline in relative Russian economic and therefore military power. again, very important element of the story. The rise of Germany in the latter half of the 19th century, overtaking even the British by such measures as steel production for the eve of the First World War. Yeah. Again, you know, this is a rough sense for how power relations are changing. And then also outside Europe, the rise of the United States, quite extraordinary. United States, 1750, 0.1% of world manufacturing output. By 1900, it was up to a quarter. You know. This is an important phenomenon. Okay. Finally, demographics. 19th century, a period of very rapid population growth in Europe as a whole, and in all the European countries except for France. There's a period of relative French demographic stagnation, which transforms France's position from the great European power at the time of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic period to just one of a number of states, by no means the most important, maybe number three. But demographic growth in Europe as a whole is extremely important. Because it creates the sense of, does our existing territory suffice to provide for our needs into the indefinite future? With our population growing by leaps and bounds, will we be able to feed ourselves in the future? Don't we need more land? Which is a notion that comes into play in the latter half of the century, especially in connection with the rise of Darwinism, the whole Darwin philosophy. Very, very important. Also, when you have a rapidly increasing population, you have a disproportionately large number of young people, vigorous people, it creates the sense of dynamism, sense of events on the move. Again, these things are very important to bear in mind. Those are fundamental elements in the structure of great power politics during the 19th century. They're the background. They're the backdrop. They're things that you just have to bear in mind. They themselves don't tell us everything we want to know about how international politics works. But they're fundamental in terms of setting the stage. This is a period of dramatic political, social, economic change, the entry. Is the fact of that change going to be manageable? Is this going to be a violent period? Well, how can these changes be managed? What sorts of policies should be put in place? Well, that was the problem of the statesmen who met at Vienna at the end of the Napoleonic Wars. The Congress of Vienna, 1814, 1815, had to consider, and that's what we'll be talking about next time. Cool. See you later.